Welcome back to Plot Pit. William Atkinson here with
John LeMay.
And we forge fiction from fact and folklore. Today we are continuing our author trilogy episode sequence. This is episode 2, the author interview with Roy Griffiths, who goes by Griff.
Hey, fellas. Nice to be back with you.
We had fun in our Jack the Ripper episode, and we are going to begin the descent into Roy Griffiths' work. Specifically, we're going to highlight his book, The Thing from HR. So let's do it. Griff, why don't you give us an introduction of yourself and your work?
All right. I had a religious experience when I was 10, and that's when I decided to be a writer. The short version is family drama sent me to some grandparents I didn't know really very well at all. They'd come from the deep south, so they had some communication styles that weren't good for an introverted, scared kid. But I'd already learned the power of reading to take us out of ourselves and take us away. And I wandered into a little used bookstore. I was already reading a lot at that point in time. And somebody had left The Princess of Mars series by Edgar Rice Burroughs. I knew the name. I knew Edgar Rice Burroughs from my dad and I watching the old Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan shows. And he'd been telling me, that this guy named Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote the stories. So it had a lurid cover. I still remember it to this day. It was a Ballantine paperback. So this, what would this have been? It would have been like 1969 or something. So I dropped a quarter, grabbed it, pedaled back to the place I was staying, and I found a corner where nobody would bother me. And I started reading, and man, I came back from Mars 8 hours later, just a changed person. Something about the writing or the story just engulfed me. It transported me, and, I was there with John Carter, side by side, fighting the Tharks or whatever else he did. And I remember so clearly, this is no bullshit, that I put down the book and I thought to myself, this is real magic. This is what I want to do. I'm going to be a writer. And that was it, man. I of course started diving into all the other classics like Burroughs. Now Burroughs certainly has some issues, but man, he could write a story. Bless him. I mean, that sprang from who knows where. That was the gods sending a thunderbolt down to, probably was handwritten, his manuscript. And so I started reading all his stuff. And then, of course, that led me to other writers. I started working on my first novel. It was probably a very terrible fan fiction version of Princess of Mars. So the less said about that, the better.
Oh, I'm going to ask about it later because I love Burroughs. So, I mean, you got to tell us the good parts about it later.
Well, that'll be like no episode at all.
Oh, there's no good parts.
Fan fiction.
Come on.
Kid, man. Come on.
Throw us a bone. Well, just tell us some of it. Come on. It sounds like it's really cool.
I'll tell you one part. It turns out I have an affection for kind of the regular guy hero. And we'll talk about more, I guess, in the thing from HR. But, it helped that John Carter in the books had been like a former Confederate cavalryman. Burroughs was a cavalryman himself. You may or may not know that. And then you think of Robert E. Howard writing, Solomon Kane and Conan. These were formidable folks. But for whatever reason, even when I was 10, I remember that the lead character was just sort of a regular dude who tripped into this fantasy location world, whatever it was. And it just struck me. I hadn't thought about that in years. I've tried to block it from my memory, clearly. That's all I can tell you, man. Regular guy.
What about the title? Just tell us the title. Did you title it something cool?
I can't remember. Seriously, it was so long ago.
Oh, okay.
Before I even learned to type, although, let's see, so I hand wrote it and kept it in a little binder. And then, probably in a fit of rationality, I burned it, I'm sure. And then, like 2 years later, I learned to type and it was on. But yeah, I read all these guys. I started writing. I just started writing and I don't know, stories in my head. Kept reading. I worked my way through the Heinleins. I discovered really fast that I was much more interested in a story than the accuracy of the science necessarily. And I mean, I gotta be honest, I found, like Asimov, tedious. Just tedious going, at least in the novels. I can handle some of his short stories, but the novels bored me stiff because I don't know. They just didn't do it for me. But Heinlein, some of the Niven stuff, The Mote in God's Eye, which I just thought was great. And then I just sort of started getting tuned into stories, particularly like movies. I really clicked into movies kind of for the same reason, because I realized probably, I mean, I was only 14 or 15 when I realized this, or it struck me, was that movies seem to be the closest thing to a shared dream we could actually have. You know, you're sitting in there with a great movie like Zulu, right? You're in the theater with, it's dark, you're there with 500 strangers, but if it's a good movie, you can have like this shared emotional experience. You know, you'll laugh together, you'll gasp together, you'll cry.
You know, that's a really interesting way of describing the experience of a movie, as a shared dream. That's certainly a unique description. I've never heard that before.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, that's, for some reason it struck me. And that was probably coming from my place of being the lonely, introverted geek. But it was just, it seemed so powerful to me, you know. And as you get older and you see bad movies, you know, you're like, oh, yeah, this is a shared nightmare.
So with that said, you mentioned seeing bad movies. I mean, we've talked about movies being dumb on this show a couple of times. And my question, I'm going to toss it out there because I don't know if I have a legitimate answer for it. And that is, are any movies truly bad? Case in point, Mystery Science Theater 3000 has taken what people have traditionally thought of as really bad movies and then did something with it to actually make it quite entertaining, minus The Hands of Fate being the case point.
Okay. Well, I think it depends on what you expect from your storytelling. As I've gotten older, to me, a bad story is one that debases and diminishes the reader or the viewer.
That's a good definition.
Which is different than, you know, sort of the exciting thrill ride. You know, Independence Day isn't going to necessarily change anybody's life, but at the same time, I don't think you come away from it feeling, you know, dirty. Whereas in 1 week, you know, on two consecutive weekends, 1 weekend I saw Pulp Fiction, which I thought was just garbage. It was, you know, written at a high school, junior high level, personally. And then the next weekend I saw Babe. And to me, that was the entire spectrum, because Pulp Fiction was nothing about elevating or ennobling anyone who watched it. It might as well have been some junior high guys who had snuck into the dad's liquor cabinet just riffing on cool shit. And then you see Babe on the other end, which was, you know, just a work of beauty. And anyway, that just kind of solidified it for me. So that's kind of my criteria for what I consider good or bad storytelling. You know, I mean, there can be powerful stuff that I think is bad, but I don't want any part of it.
Now, all of this started when you were 10 years old, and you talked about the power of the book being able to transport you, or you used the word specifically, mm-hmm. magic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go into that just a little bit more, if you would.
Okay, well, for me, like I said, it was, at first, it was about, you know, taking me away from, you know, a really uncomfortable emotional situation. First, I wasn't equipped to deal with. And second, I shouldn't have had to deal with. So that alone, it was a safe escape in that sense.
Now, what you mentioned, you know, wanting stories to uplift or ennoble,
yep.
you know, the viewer, the listener, the reader, or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you have any reason to believe that those two connections, that those two particular elements connect, you know, the time that you were 10 years old that you opened the episode with, and then this desire for that story to be able to emotionally resonate and uplift?
You know, I think part of that was just kind of growing older. I mean, oh God, I was a promiscuous film goer when I was younger. I would go see a movie just because a makeup person whose work I knew was in it, regardless of whether the movie was any good. I'm thinking of The Incredible Melting Man. It was early Rick Baker work, and I just went to see for that. Gosh, that was trash. But I think, as I got older, I don't know if it was a maturity thing or maybe just sort of getting in touch with the idea that there's consequences, and maybe even, I think I began to look at writing, knowing at least its power on me and on the, you know, other people, that I had kind of a responsibility. And, you know, and I thought about, like I said, some of the, James Ellroy wrote some really powerful stuff, but at a certain point I said, man, I just don't need to see any more, you know, sadistic Nazis, you know, evil cops, hookers with no heart. You know, it was just ugly. There was a consistent there was a reveling in the ugliness that I just didn't want to support. I just didn't want to be a part of. I remember when I read the sequel to The Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, I felt debased, and I said, you know, I thought unkind things about the author. I said, why would you write this? You know, what possible reason is there to write this? And that's when I got a lot more selective about what I read, because, you know, yeah, it's part of a sort of evolving thing, but, you know, I joined the Coast Guard, I think I mentioned that, and that was a real turning point in my life when I went out for being a rescue swimmer. But I started really keying in on story, not just as a product we consume, but it began to become clear to me that story is how we make sense of the world. And more than that, and again, this is all my opinion, so, you know, nobody get mad at the host, that we understand things by stories. You know, when you're trying to, I don't know, tie a knot. Well, the rabbit goes in the hole and he goes around the tree, you know, stuff like that, to, you know, we're always sort of referencing something else to learn something new. Even if we're talking about quantum physics, they got to kind of, if you're going to make that next leap, they're still going to refer back to spooky attraction at a distance, you know, Einstein, Planck, and then they're going to build on that. But there's still that story. So that's my belief, is that we tell ourselves a story to make sense of the world. And then it hit me that we tell ourselves a story about who we are, and that determines our life. And I read a lot of, when I wasn't writing historical fiction, I read a lot of memoirs, and, you know, because I was really interested about how people figured out their place in the world and why they made the choices they did. I remember reading something about, a sociologist wrote about gangs in Los Angeles. And, you know, his contention was a lot of these gang members had no father figure. And in a gang, they would find a sort of a pseudo family. And, you know, he was talking about the Crips and the Bloods and why, talking about, yeah, their family, the story of their family was, we are people who will murder another human being for wearing the wrong color umbrella. You know, and on one hand, you look at it and go, in what sane world would that make sense? And it makes sense in a world where you tell yourself, I am a person, because I am a Blood or a Crip, I am a person who will kill someone else for wearing the wrong color bandana, because that's the story they told themselves. So going back to my Coast Guard thing, I'd been a drama geek in high school. No sports, because we moved around. My dad was in the Air Force, and that's really not good for kind of getting into that thing. But I was a drama geek, didn't learn to throw a softball until I was 22. Totally out of the whole physical realm. But I had an early midlife crisis at about 22. And I went to the Coast Guard, and I said, man, I got to find some personal challenge. I just so happened the rescue swimmer program was being developed, and one of the things that caught my eye was they said it was the second toughest school in the Navy. It was so new, in fact, we went to the Navy for the rescue, the aviation rescue portion. You know, we could do a lot of other training, but the Coast Guard didn't have the, you know, the special pool and the fire hoses beating down on you and all the stuff that they got us to experience. So I saw that part and went, that's the challenge I need. So it was tough, and fortunately, you know, I learned a lot about teamwork and all this other stuff that I'd never had a clue about. But the biggest thing, I learned two big things. One was, you know, that your brain will quit before your body does, which was a very interesting thing. I had to sort of experience that, because somebody could have told me that and I would have scoffed. But then when I came out the other side of it, they gave me Honor Man, which just, you know, surprised the hell out of me. And this got very funny. I told people I was in high school with, and like my family about it. Everybody said, we never imagined you doing something like that. And all that made me go, wow, that changed my entire perception of myself in the sense of what I was capable of. And I realized my story that I'd been telling myself, which became my paradigm for the world and how I related to it, was limiting me. And that's when I really started thinking hard about this whole idea of the stories we tell ourselves. If I have a philosophy, it's basically change your story, change your life. Another sociological thing I loved hearing. You've gone silent. Am I boring you guys?
No, we're just letting you talk. We're listening.
So far, it's fascinating.
Another thing the sociologist said, And by the way, in the thing from HR, I give sociologists a really hard time. But a sociologist had this really interesting observation, which was that people act as if the stories they tell themselves are true. It's like, whoa, you know, I mean, if the story I'm telling myself is the system's out to get me, the man's out to keep me down, chicks hate me, and dogs don't even like me. If that's the story I'm telling myself, that's how I'm going to respond to the world.
Like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely. It's like, what was it? The Poe story where the guy gets walled up in the cellar. Was it the Cask of Monteado? You know, for the love of God, Montresor, I think. But it was me, you know, walling myself up in the cellar by the story I was telling myself. So,
you know, that's really interesting that you bring that up. About 15 years or so ago, when I was in college, I came across some psychological literature that had made the hypothesis and had some supporting arguments that were rather convincing going along with it, that effectively stated we are not physically and emotionally and mentally capable of behaving in any way that would violate our subconscious beliefs about the world and its morality. If we have a deeply held sense of value in something, we cannot violate that.
So I think this started with one of your questions originally, and I'm not sure if I'm literally answering it, but we were talking about ennobling and uplifting people versus, you know, debasing them. All that, I guess, was sort of talking about how I began to realize the story was really important. It also is a reason why I tend to have little use for a lot of modern or popular modern literature, because, you know, I was exposed to some of it, especially the hot stuff in, you know, like the 60s and then all these guys who'd been in World War II, more or less coming back and being disillusioned by their life. And of course, they may have been doing a lot of drinking and whoring, which could contribute to that. And I just have no interest in reading stories that are essentially saying life is awful, people are terrible, why bother? To me, that is such a weenie approach, because unless you're chained to the wall of a North Korean prison, most people have incredible amounts of choice. Our choices have a large, large part to do with how our lives turn out. You know, the flip side of the question, of course, is everything costs. There is nothing free. Even salvation costs somebody something, and it wasn't us, for those of you who ascribe to the Christian belief. There's a cost to our choices, and if we don't want to pay that, we get a different choice. As part of the uplifting and stuff, I believe we have a choice, and the choices determine the outcome of our life, man. And that is what most of my books are about in a sort of a thematic sense. I mean, I wrote this 6-volume historical fiction series called By the Hands of Men, and there's your theme right there, man. It's the old, our hands can make a heaven or a hell of life on Earth. You know, we can be North Korea, or we could be the United States for all of its flaws. But that becomes somebody's choice. And there's a reason more people are trying to leave North Korea than they are trying to get in. All that's to say, I want to write something that reminds people they have a choice. They can change their lives for the better if they're willing to do it.
Now, how did you do that with the thing from HR?
Ha! Okay. Man, oh, you're calling me out. I just felt that right there, man. Well, a little more context, just on my whole writing career. There's a reason I don't have a writing career per se. I have a real tough problem writing the same thing over and over and over. You know, I wrote short stories about whatever I imagined or whatever caught my mind. When I was in the Coast Guard at the air station, they had a newsletter and they knew what, you know, I wrote, because I was still writing plays and winning a few one-act play awards, which was nice. And they said, hey, can you write us something for the station newsletter? Cool. And I'd had, let me digress just one quick second. One of the things I really liked about our interview and the first Plot Pit interview was you guys hit upon the way I actually tend to write a lot of stuff, is some like idea or fact or something somebody says or I hear it will spark me. It'll spark an idea, it'll spark a question. And it was just kind of fun to be doing that with you guys, because it's the same kind of thing. It's the same process. You know, this woman, she was doing a set on a play I'd written, and she was an English woman, and this was 40 years ago. Lovely lady, and we were talking one day, and she was telling me about her grandfather, who had fought in World War I, and he said that one of the worst things about being in the trenches was listening to the screaming of the wounded horses and not being able to do anything about it. You know, just like our plot pit, that was a true story. And I think the first thought that went through my mind was, how could you sit there and listen to that and not try to do something? And, you know, but anyway, it sparks me. So I was writing screenplays because I love movies, and I actually worked for a year in Hollywood. Most of the stories here about Hollywood, I would suggest, are true. I had the complete Hollywood experience of selling a movie to Fox TV. Then they fired the VP who bought the project and dumped out all of his projects, including mine. It was festive. And at a certain point, I had to say, I'm a single dad with like a five-year-old kid who needs insurance and toys for Christmas, so I got to get real. I substitute taught during the day, and I took some classes at night, and I got into PC work to pay the bills. I kept working on screenplays. I had some ones that I thought were really good, and other people did too. But at a certain point, you know, executives don't typically, they don't read the stuff first off. They have assistants, they have layers of assistants, an entire hierarchy of people who will finally boil your 2 years of hard work and sweat and tears down to, it's the Poseidon Adventure meets the Great Escape. You know, that probably wouldn't work these days, because how many Hollywood executives rolled in to actually know what the Great Escape is? But the other thing is you're going through the levels, right, to get to the exec, to get to that elevator pitch moment. People read your stuff, and maybe they've had their people. At a certain point, they want to call you in for a meeting, which does two things. One, it gives them a chance to data mine you for ideas for free, but it's also a chance for them to give you notes. So, you know, like I said, you've worked on the script for 2 years, you really believe in it or whatever. You walk into a room and there's like four, maybe five, 26-year-old MBAs who've never written a damn thing in their life. And they're going to give you notes on your script because they know maybe what's trendy. They know what's selling. They know who's hot. They know who's not. And you're like, oh God, okay, fine. Yeah. Give me your note. You know, can we make it for Steven Seagal? No, we can't make it for Steven Seagal. But I remember here was another one of those religious experiences. One guy said to me, this was my currently award-winning script. It won the John Milius Award a couple years ago for feature film screenplay. It was about some stuff took place in the Korean War. And this youthful MBA person said to me, you know, I got to get back to you on this script. I've got to check and find out if it's okay to make the North Koreans the bad guy. And my eye, you know, starts to twitch. Like, well, first, did you read the script? Do you even know what the Korean War is? And that just kind of broke me. It's like, oh man, this is like the death of a thousand paper cuts. And I stopped writing screenplays, and then I just sort of drifted into novels for myself. And I wrote the historical fiction series, which people like, and you can also find that on Amazon. It's called By the Hands of Men. It took about 6 years, did a lot of research because it starts in World War I in the trenches and covers two decades, four continents. It's a big sweeping saga. And I really wanted it to feel authentic to the time period. So I did a lot of research on the, you know, social stuff, historical events, revolutions, culture, things like that. And at the same time, then you have to be really careful because you don't want to bludgeon people with this. And you have to learn sort of the subtle art of what I call the telling detail. Just something that makes it feel real. And not like, you know, not like we're reading, say, a romance. But anyway, a lot of work, 6 years, very serious piece of work. I dare say, I hope it's actually literature, you know, because I wanted to tell a ripping story, but I also wanted to tell a good story, a worthwhile story. So I just finished that up, and I had some luck with getting some publicity, and so sold, I don't know, 1,000, 1,500 copies, which is great. And I was just about to that point where I was going to take a breath and say, well, I guess I see what I'm going to write next. And my high school girlfriend died. And this lady had been my first love and my first and forever fan. She died, you know, very suddenly and sadly. And to my surprise, it kicked my slats in, because I figured I'd have another 20 years to be, you know, I would mail this lady. Here's a novel. Read this. Here's a screenplay. Read this. I thought I had 20 more years to do it. So that hit me pretty hard. And then my mom died 6 months later.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't write anything, not a damn thing for a year. I don't think I even wrote a grocery list. So I finally start to, you know, come out of this. And I can't write anything serious to save my life. And I've had this wacky idea that came to me because, you know, it's just stuff out there drifting. I don't know if I'm plugged into anything or, if, you know, it's, I need to adjust my meds. But I work in corporate IT as my day job. And God bless them for that. But yeah, it's probably 2 years ago. I was looking at a bunch of resumes. And you guys know resumes go through trends and acceptable, you know, what everybody's doing. You know, maybe it's Times New Roman. That's verboten. Don't do that. And so nobody does that. And then they want to go with whatever. A picture, no picture, fine. Okay. The market was a little different then. So I get like 90 resumes for an entry-level job. And so I kind of flipping through them. At a certain point, I started to notice this pattern, which was the mission statement was big at the time. You know, personal mission statement.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But what I noticed was everybody was a thought leader. You know, I'm a network engineer, and I speak three languages, and I'm a thought leader. And at a certain point, I went, what a vacuous term. You know, I do interpretive tap dance, and I'm a thought leader. What does that mean? And because probably I was bored going through my 60 or 70th resume, I was just idly wondering what would be a more fatuous term to put on my resume than thought leader. And out of nowhere, this idea, this term came to me, the blithering excrescence from beyond the stars. I just kind of like the assonance and the flow of it.
That has a nice cadence to it.
Yeah. It's veritably poetry, I tell you. So then I asked like the next question, because that's where a lot of my writing comes from, is, well, like I said about the trenches and the wounded horses, you know, this question occurs to me, how could you hear that in other things? My question for this was, well, where would the blithering excrescence from beyond the stars work? And the answer is for the Cthulhu organization, of course. And it just kind of went from there, man. Having worked in corporate America, it also just kind of struck me. I said, oh, wait, any large organization has got, they've got somebody's, you know, got to write the traveler's checks or buy the toilet paper or keep the copiers running. And then I just kind of, it just started, I wouldn't say spiraling out of control, but it started taking on a life of its own as I, kind of like what you said, just imagining the various gibbering horrors from beyond, you know, in the hell of a corporate environment. And, you know, I thought, well, who would, you know, who'd be doing all the scut work? And it would clearly be a Shuggoth. I just went from there, man.
So what was your first experience with Lovecraft?
Oh, it was during that early discovery period, you know, probably, I would say.
So during that Pulp Fiction 10 to 15 growing up zone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Probably, I'd say around late high school, so 17, 18. I remember reading the original short story, Call of Cthulhu. I was like, man, this is some messed up stuff, but it's still pretty original.
And it's out there. Yeah, I agree. It's one of the things that I've enjoyed about a lot of the Pulp Fiction is Lovecraft's work. And when you obviously trace it all through, Lovecraft is given the status of father of horror. And then Alfred Hitchcock kind of took that and ran with it a little bit more with Psycho. But, you know, corporate America lifestyle feels to me very sterile and lifeless in many ways.
Yeah.
The title of your book, The Thing from HR, right? It really has that stark contrast of the corporate HR setting, water cooler, you know, non-controversial conversations and just that sterile lifestyle of the Oxford button-up shirt, right?
Right.
John might have even heard me talk about the Oxford Forest, and that's exactly what it is. It's just crisp and clean and lifeless and sterile. And The Thing from HR like shakes it up in my head, just that phrase itself.
Yeah. Most places I've worked, HR has been kind of the enemy. And that was where it started in my head. But, you know, when I write often, I have ideas all the time. I mean, you know, there's book titles out there. Here's just two book titles. One's called Elephant Ranch. The other's called Touch Me There, which was mostly started as a joke. But I was thinking the sequels write themselves. There's Touch Me There, and there's Touch Me There Again. Have Your Friend Touch Me There. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
But So I have ideas all the time, and they're just kind of free-floating. But what I find is I get something like this idea for Cthulhu Amalgamated, and it starts to take on a life of its own a little bit. So then to start out writing novels, it's been kind of a voyage of discovery for me. I've discovered the way I work best is I have a sort of an initial image, in this case, my Shuggoth, my slub Shuggoth working in HR. And I have sort of an ending image. And so once those line up correctly, which is what happened with By the Hands of an Historical Fiction, originally, I thought it was going to be one book. But, you know, there'd been an idea from when I was in my 20s, then an idea that was that hit me in my late 30s. Those ideas one day, when I was about 50, lined up. I went, oh, okay. So once they line up, I start at the beginning and fight my way to the end. But once I do that, sort of like once I commit to that, it becomes this kind of vessel that other ideas go into. It becomes magnetized to the right sorts of ideas that will work with this particular story I'm telling at the time, if that makes any sense. So there's a point to that, but there it is. The Cthulhu Amalgamate, something about it. First, it amused me. And I guess that's the other point that's really important to mention was, like I said, I couldn't write anything serious. And this was such a goofy idea. It's an idea so goofy, people would say, don't write it. And my wife did, because she just didn't get it. But I told myself, you know, I'm just going to be as goofy as I want. That was sort of the creative challenge I put to myself, was to not restrict myself or censor myself. And once I did that, man, the weirdness started happening. And it became good stuff. And because it was a really interesting setup that allowed me to, you know, talk and be snarky about a lot of stuff and still try to make it still try to make it ultimately positive, which can be a real challenge in the Lovecraftian world, believe me.
Well, I was going to say, you really defied my expectations of you, because so I'm not a Lovecraft Cthulhu type guy, but I tend to stereotype that stuff as being very dark and grim, and you're so positive, and you like movies like Babe versus Pulp Fiction. So for me, that's a very pleasant surprise and very unforeseen.
Yeah, well, here, let me give you the talk right off of Amazon. It's, you know, what's a nice Shuggoth like him doing in a dump like this? Narg was content working as a Damnation Services 10 in HR. Sure, he was related to one of the elder gods, but a little nepotism never hurt anything. His life was just wailing and gibbering right up until his uncle needed a small favor from his nephew. All Narg had to do was go down among the humans and pretend to be one of them. These are not your grandfather's tales of eldritch horror. This is the untold story of the ghastly, unappreciated, and entirely expendable minor monstrosities that support the inscrutable plans of dark gods and elder things beyond the knowledge of men. The Cthulhu Amalgamated series is a comic romp full of action and mystery, including, of course, sanity-shattering horror. And that's just the paperwork. Even HP could not conceive of the corporate terrors that await the thing from HR.
You know, when I first read that, my mind hit a whole new level. Because, as John mentioned, you know, the whole Lovecraftian world is very dark and grim and cosmic horror and everything. And I love that. John's got a different taste of literature. But I'm a big Lovecraft fan. And I've done Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing, but my favorite genre to play in when I do get to the paper tabletop games is Call of Cthulhu. And I just like that dark and grim cosmic horror descent into madness.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you tied it to paperwork and HR, just, it was not a figurative chuckle. I literally chuckled when I read that blurb.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. I just had to do it. And it also, there's one of y'all asked me earlier, you know, how could I have uplifting and ennobling in, you know, and choice, you know, personal choice in a Cthulhu kind of book. One of the things I was wondering about is, you know, sort of the question of, and again, you see this in bad writing, and you saw it in pulp. You can sort of excuse it in pulp because, you know, these guys are pounding out 40,000-50,000 words on manual typewriters every 3 weeks, poor bastards. It was just a question of, are they bad things because they're bad things, or are they bad things because they're told this is what we are? And that became sort of a thread I began exploring through the whole three books. So, yeah, so people found it pretty funny, and they've actually found it, ironically, I wouldn't say life-affirming, but also not what they expected.
Now, you mentioned that it's difficult to weave comic into cosmic horror.
Yeah.
Or Lovecraft with Laughcraft, as we've dubbed it a little bit earlier.
Right.
What were some of those challenges that you faced while writing those books?
Man, there's so much. I think what's the idea struck me that it was a corporation, which meant that there was like this org chart and stuff. And it made me think of like people way down the org chart don't necessarily know all the big plans, and they bumble along as best they can. So it became, well, one person said that it's a comedy of errors, that my heroes blunder from one awkward situation to another. And that was kind of my thing, because, you know, he wasn't just a fish out of water. He was a thing out of time and space, because he gets dumped into a college in 1937. Was it? Let's see. Yeah. He's shoehorned into a human body and given the soul of a dead human as a native guide. Unfortunately, neither Narg nor the former human Murph have any idea what the assignment is or how to accomplish it. So already I've kind of got the fun there. You know, the strangest of strangers in a strange land. But, you know, trying to understand humans and their culture, and then, you know, at the same time, trying to put it from his point of view, the point of view of a creature who existed essentially outside of time and space, and having to deal with the limitations of all of a sudden I'm a chronologically limited being in this time, whereas in this location. So there was a lot there you could play with. I mean, a lot of the comedy of errors, you know, the cultural misunderstandings and things like that.
That's just awesome. Now, you mentioned you got three of these books out.
Yep. The Thing from HR is also an Audible, and man, you got to go listen to the sample. I got this great narrator, and you know, it was fall down funny. It sounds like boasting, but the guy just took it to another level. He's great. That was the first book. Second book is called The Auditors of Doom. Third book is called The Break Room of a Thousand Nightmares.
Those are all great. I love them.
The Break Room of a Thousand Nightmares.
Yeah, wow. My son gave me that title, right? He's a good geek, you know, in good standing. And you know, he'd read some Lovecraft, so he read The Thing from HR, and we were talking about, you know, the third book, and he said, The Break Room of a Thousand Nightmares. I went, sold. Let's go.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So that's a trilogy of books.
Yes, sir.
Mixing laughter with Lovecraft. That is certainly unique. I've never seen anything quite like it before.
Oh, thanks, man. I hope you guys check it out. But yeah, I'm really pleased with how it turned out. I mean, that is one of the cool things about writing. Well, being a freelance writer, you can figure, well, I got to the point where I said, you know, I wrote for free for a long time. I'll just keep writing for free and I'll write what I want. But one of the fun things about, you know, self-publishing and that sort of stuff, first is it's great to hear from readers. That's a trip, man. I mean, I know when I was a young reader, I would write, you know, I wrote letters to Harlan Ellison and Joseph Wambach and guy who wrote Shane, Jack Schaefer. And they were cool enough to write me back, which was great. So it's really cool for me to hear from readers. But the other part is that freedom of just saying, I think this sounds like fun. I don't have to go through the, you know, death of a thousand paper cuts, go through the MBAs who've never written anything. I'm just going to write this and see what happens. And, you know, I just surprised myself. I was thinking, where did somebody come from? And my dad, you know, the guy who introduced me to Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, God love him, he's been supportive of my writing. So I sent him a copy of the Thing from HR. And he eventually got back to me. He said, you know, that was okay, but I was wondering what you were on when you were writing it. But cool.
Oh, I could believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, folks, we have Roy Griffiths here on the phone with us. We've been talking to Griff. That's his preferred name. Griff, you've written three books in this Cthulhu mythos. Why don't you give us those titles one more time?
Sure. You can find them on Amazon under Roy M. Griffiths. It's The Thing from HR, which is also available in audiobook. The Auditors of Doom, which are the continuing adventures of Narg. and The Break Room of a Thousand Nightmares, which continues them again.
And where can we find you on social media?
Social media. You can find me at roymgriffiths.com. I am on Facebook as Roy M. Griffiths Storyteller. And Twitter, Storyteller_Roy.
Well, folks, Roy Griffiths, Griff, thank you for being on the show here today with us. We've got you scheduled for one more this week, coming out tomorrow. That will be exciting.
Looking forward to it.
All right. And folks, if you're interested in being on the program, if you're interested in submitting some of your work, send us an email at submissions@plotpit.com. You can catch us out on Twitter, YouTube, as well as Twitch. We're going to be doing some live streams here soon. More details coming. In the meantime, William Atkinson here with
John LeMay.
And we are going to call this episode a done deal. Again, thank you, Griff, for your time today.
Man, it was great. Thanks.
Awesome. Stick around for more information a little bit later on tomorrow's episode. We'll catch you around, folks.
All right, fellas. Talk to you later.